need for income policy. While the above mentioned measures are helpful, these lack a perspective given by an income policy, which alone can provide the limits to which the leveling down and leveling up need to be carried out. Without such a framework, these features may be carried a bit too far, thereby affecting adversely the productive efficiency of the system. In order that the desirable inequalities as incentives remain, the government need to follow an appropriate income policy which keeps the ratio between the highest income and the lowest income at the society acceptable figure. In other words, unlike in the free market where there can be no limit on this ratio, the government should have a policy which puts a ceiling on this ratio. If one goes by the recommendations of the Fifth Pay Commission, the ratio should be 10:1. This ratio, of course, relates only to the income structure of the central government employees. But this can well be the starting point of arriving at the figure which can fit well with the realities in respect of other income earners in the economy, such as those in informal, unorganized and formal or organized sectors. Besides considering money or nominal incomes, one should also take into view such matters for calculating real incomes, as security or insecurity of job, availability or non-availability of free prerequisites, nature of work, being on job satisfaction, etc. What all this means is that while we work for reducing inequalities, we should aim at achieving socially desirable inequalities. The next subheading is massive poverty. While going through facts and figures about distribution of income, a picture of dire poverty emerges. It is therefore appropriate that we detail out this picture in its various aspects or to have a proper view of the problem of poverty. For this, an understanding of the concept of poverty and its magnitude is a necessary first step. Concept and measurement. For an understanding of the problem of poverty and its solution, one should first be clear about the concept of poverty itself. This will also help us in measuring the magnitude of poverty in the country. Absolute poverty. In India, the concept of poverty has been approached in the absolute sense. In other words, it is not related to the income or consumption expenditure distribution. If one relates it to the distribution of income or consumption expenditure, it is a concept in relative sense. In the relative sense, it is considered to be useful for developed countries where there is no or little absolute poverty. The concept of absolute poverty is relevant for the less developed countries where absolute poverty abounds. To measure it, absolute norms for living are first laid down. These relate to some minimum standard of living. These may be expressed or measured in terms of income or consumption expenditure. Given this, one classifies all those as poor who fall below this standard. The number and proportion of such poor in the country's population gives the measure of poverty. For purposes of the measurement of poverty, consumption expenditure is considered more appropriate and relevant than income. The reason is that the actual consumption expenditure, which determines the living standard of a consumer unit, that is household, is not always met wholly out of the current income. Such an expenditure can also be met from assets, debts and this savings. Poverty line. In India, consumption expenditure has been made the basis for the measurement of the minimum standard. The usual method is to fix a poverty level. This level is expressed in terms of an overall per capita consumption expenditure. This consumption expenditure is such as in needed to ensure a certain minimum calorie intake, which in turn is derived from the information on food articles. Then all those who cannot undertake consumption expenditure required for the minimum calorie intake fall below the poverty line. The extent of poverty is measured by estimating the number and the proportion of population whose overall per capita consumption expenditure lies below the poverty line. In figures, the poverty norm is anchored in terms of daily intake of 2400 calories in the rural areas and 2100 calories in the urban areas. The consumption basket representing this calorie intake is then converted into a monetary equivalent by using price indices separately for rural and urban areas. This gives the figures for consumption expenditure for the rural and urban areas. Of course, these figures of consumption expenditure change with the changes in price, that is, the norm of calorie intake remaining the same. Those who do not incur this much consumption expenditure are identified as poor. Those thus identified live below the poverty line. Next, coming to problem of poverty. The poverty in India is a problem with some grave dimensions. It is, on the one hand, qualitatively a very big problem, as the number of the poor or those below the poverty line is indeed a massive one. Another aspect is that it is a problem of very low productivity of the poor. These people are resource poor in terms of assets, skills, credit availability, etc. This makes their earnings to be dismally small. Equally serious is the fact that the poor, belonging as they do mostly to the socially deprived or weaker section of society, have no means, political or social, to uplift themselves on their own. Huge numbers. As per the latest estimate, 1999 to 2000, as many as 260 million people of India live below poverty line, that is 1993 to 94. This constitutes as much as 26.1% of the total population of the country. The poor in the rural areas are 27.1% of the rural population. These in the urban areas accounts for 23.6% of the urban population. While this is the overall figures, the poverty is very widespread in some states. In Orissa, for example, as many as 47.15% of its population falls below the poverty line. Next, in Bihar is 42.60% of its population suffering from acute poverty. In Madhya Pradesh, the percentage of the poor is 37.43%. Uttar Pradesh has 31.15% poor. The position of the 7 northeastern states is equally bad, with the percentage of people below the poverty line ranging between 19% to 37%. Tamil Nadu and Karnataka have 21% and 20% of their population below the poverty line. Comparatively better off states are Punjab 6.16%, Andhra Pradesh 16%, Haryana 9%, Kerala 13%, and Rajasthan 15%. Next is low productivity. Considered in numbers or poverty ratio, the massive poverty is a serious problem. This, however, only sizes up the problem and states that it is a big task to face. But for identifying causes and devising measures, it is necessary to lay one's finger on the contents of the problem. Poverty is essentially a problem of low or almost nil productivity of the poor. These people either do not produce or produce very little. so that their incomes remain low for a level of consumption expenditure that can lift them above their miserable livings. The low productivity is associated with several weaknesses or handicaps from which these people suffer. For example, many are in sectors which are non-growing and they cannot get out of them till they are supplied with means or skills for the growing sectors. Or they work on assets which fetch little because these assets are out of shape or technologically out of date, or the inputs are insufficient or bad, or the marketing or credit and other infrastructure facilities to use them are inadequate or defective, etc. There are again many who do not get work or get inadequate work, so that they earn nothing or little or paid low, very low wages. In brief, these people lack means to be productive enough for a reasonable living. Next is weaker sections. These poor belong mostly to the socially weaker section of the people. In rural areas, these are the landless laborers, small and marginal farmers, rural artisans, including fishermen, and backward classes and backward tribes. The urban poor, quite many of them immigrants from villages, live in slums and on pavements. Most of them are in the unorganized sector doing petty jobs. The problem of poverty is thus mostly of the weaker section of the society. Unfortunately, these people are put at the low status in the India's social system, and they have been so placed since long in the past. These are also the people who have never wielded political power. These economically poor people are weak also socially and politically. Now coming to the next subheading, the causes of poverty. In view of the big size and the serious nature of the problem of poverty, it is necessary to find out the solution for its eradication. As a preliminary to this, it is essential to dwell upon its causes. This will enable us to suggest measures to solve problems. In this, the first cause is paradox of poverty with growth. In this discussion of causes, it is helpful to stress the point that Indian economy is beset with a paradox or contradiction, and it is that while the Indian economy has been growing over the years, the fact of poverty continues to plague it. The growth since 1951 has been 4%. In recent years, this has been still higher, with 5% in 1980s and around 6% in 1990s. The saving and the investment ratio have also been on the rise, placing India among the middle income countries of the world. Capital stock, infrastructure and skilled manpower have increased a lot. Agricultural and industrial production too have shown rising trends. Food grains production has increased much, resulting in the build-up of large stocks. The economy is getting modernized with green revolution of the agricultural sector and the latest technology or products in the variety of industries lines. In brief, the economy has grown and is growing, but this positive progress of the economy is marred by the ugly fact that massive poverty continues to exist. Why is this so? The causes of poverty need to be spelled out to explain this paradox. We describe them under the following four heads. The first one is little trickle down effect. An important set of factors responsible for this situation is that the beneficial effects of growth did not reach large masses of the people. Although plans for development involved large areas and resulted in large production, the effects could trickle downwards only to the small extent. The income of the large many did not rise significantly, nor did their consumption go up. The major reason for this may be identified as those which kept the poor out of the development process. One such reason is the development strategy itself. The emphasis all alone since the second plan until recently has been on the building of the capacity for capital goods. This meant two things. Investments in capital intensive projects or less employment generation schemes and lesser resources availability for consumption or wage goods, as also for labor intensive industries. Together these resulted in slower growth in employment or wage income for the masses and small growth in the availability of the consumption goods. Efforts no doubt were made to promote small and cottage industries for reasons of employment and production of consumer goods, but the progress was not sufficient to absorb the backlog of unemployment and the rising labor forces, as also to meet the consumption needs of the people. Second, significant factor which prevented poor from benefiting from growth has been the widening inequalities of incomes. In the capital intensive projects, the proportion of the income going as wage is bound to be low. But equally importantly, the unequal distribution of assets, partly helped by the strategy which placed premium or on non-wage incomes, has enabled the few at the top of the corner a large proportion of the national income from year to year. For this reason, even a small raise in per capita income could not reach the poor. Hence, their low per capita income compared to all Indian average and low and almost non-rising consumptions. On the other hand, with large income concentrated among the few, the production of luxury and semi-luxury goods increased much. However, governments did make efforts to level up the people at the bottom rung of the income ladder, and it did succeed to some extent. But these efforts did not yield very satisfactory results. Now, coming to the next head, which explains the paradox, is little strengthening of poor. However, the development strategy by itself largely achieved the objective of rapidly building up the economy's capacity. This strategy and the progress made under it could make sense if it had been accompanied by large transfers to favor the poor, as also efforts at raising the capabilities of the poor. Neither of these happened to extend required to uplift the poor from below the poverty line. For example, in respect of land transfers, under the policy of ceiling on land ownership and distribution of surplus land among the poor farmers, very little has been achieved, nor has the availability of the other income earning assets like tools, equipment, etc. for the poor has improved significantly. The institutional credit and the technology transfers too have remained much less than needed for expansion and modernization of their activities. As for the supplies of subsidies, inputs for production like fertilizers, water, electricity, etc., the poor have not been the sole beneficiaries. Their earning capabilities too have remained weak, with illiteracy and ill health rampant among them. The next head explaining this paradox is inadequacies of anti-poverty programs. Another supplement to the transfer could be the various special programs to ameliorate the conditions of the poor. These, however, have not as yet made substantial impact on the poverty. Some of them have been late in coming and or inadequately implemented. One very important such program is the Integrated Rural Development Program, IRDP. It is to provide assets and work to the specific poor by integrating other specific beneficiary-oriented schemes of poverty eradication. But it has not as yet benefited all those who are to be benefited. Another is National Rural Employment Program, NREP, started in 1977 and merged with the Jawahar Rozgar Yojana in 1989-90. It is to provide work paid partly in food grains and results in the creation of assets like drainage, rural roads, etc. The success in this case too have been modest. Another program also merged with the Jawahar Rozgar Yojana is the Rural Landless Employment Guarantee Program, which have reduced poverty but only to the small extent. For the urban poor, the Nehru Rozgar Yojana started in 1989-90 has yet to make its impact. Besides these, a significant scheme is Minimum Needs Program, MNP, first introduced in the 5th plan with a view of raising the productive efficiency of both the rural and urban poor. It is to do so through the provision of free or subsidized services through the public agencies in respect of elementary education, health, water supply, roads, electrification, housing assistance, environmental improvement, and nutrition. Like so many other anti-poverty schemes, it is also specific to areas and beneficiary groups. This too has not as yet met with much success in raising many people above the poverty line. All in all, these such like rightly conceived programs, despite some success to their credit, have as yet to make a remarked dent on the poverty situation. The last head which explains the paradox is fast population rise among the poor. The incidence of poverty is to an extent also caused by the population growth, which is larger among the poor than all India rate. Unfortunately, this is associated with and in fact due largely to their poverty. With poor nutrition, inadequate medical facilities, unhealthy living, etc., the mortality rate as also infant mortality rate are also high. With survival rate very low at both the ends of lifespan, the family size tend to be large as happens in the backward economies. The reproductive capacity of the poor woman is also higher. The close relation between high fertility and poverty is caused by the degeneration of some vital organs that raise fertility. Further, the psychological effect of chronic hunger makes sex an important emotional compensation for the shrunken nutritional appetite. Again, poor people are steeped in illiteracy and much attached to old unscientific attitudes. As such, they abhor birth control or are ignorant of birth control devices or do not want to use them and are unable to use them. With little employment and large-sized families, the incomes are low and consumption inadequate. So the four heads which explain the paradox are little trickle down effect, little strengthening of poor, inadequacies of anti-poverty programs and fast population rise among the poor. Now coming to the suggested measures. The massive poverty, despite some growth of the economy, calls for radical remedies to eradicate it. This is essential if growth is to have any meaning for the large many Indians. In this connection, the following lines of action can be helpful in resolving this problem. Raising incomes and consumption. The ideal solution lies in putting the theme of poverty reduction at the core of development strategy. If, however, it is put down only as one of the objectives, it is likely to be traded off with other objectives and therefore pushed down in order or priorities, particularly in a situation of acute resource scarcity. As center theme of the strategy, it will require such an ordering of priorities in respect to product mix and technology mix that goods of massive consumption or wage goods and labor intensive technologies get the highest ranking. Capital goods and capital intensive methods come into the picture as support to the core objective, that is to provide machines for consumer goods, etc., and at the late stage. Such an approach will lead to a higher growth of consumption goods and large employment opportunities for the poor. However, keeping the present realities in view, such a total change is not possible. Having pursued for long a strategy within capital goods sector and capital investment intensive technologies got a high priority with very good reasons and substantial success, it is not desirable to opt out of it. As yet, there are many important gaps to be filled in the capital goods sector, including infrastructural facilities. However, with large capacity having been built up and a large part of it remaining unutilized, a practical course is to make a fuller use of it and also to devote a considerable part of the additional resources for larger additions to the capacity for consumer goods. Likewise, much more attention need to be given to the use of labor-intensive but effective techniques in the various fields. This would imply tilting investment pattern in favor of large employment for the poor and large consumption. This solution also includes raising the provision of social consumption for the poor. An example of the same is the minimum needs program. It is to provide such items as elementary education, health, housing, water supply, electricity, etc. The increase in private consumption goods purchased by the poor plus the public consumption goods or services supplied by the government will provide the real substance to the poverty eradication strategy. Now, the special policies and programs. While the above will in general benefit the poor, this alone cannot suffice, for there are specific problems in respect of specific groups of the poor, as also specific areas that needs to be looked after with supplementary policies and programs. These groups and areas are, for example, landless agricultural laborers, artisans, hill areas people, tribal population, etc. These people lack assets and skills to earn and to increase their share in the rising national output, and they do not have the resources to acquire assets or skills. Hence, special measures need to be undertaken to put these people in their feet. These encompass policies in respect to transfer of surplus land and other income area earning assets like cattle, machines, etc. Skill formation can be promoted through the provision of education and training by the government, special programs involving the use of local resources and manpower can be devised to provide employment on wages and on self-employed basis. It needs also to be emphasized that while the general growth as also specific policies or programs will help the poor, there is great urgency for taking special steps for reducing population growth among the poor and strengthening them organizationally. The farmer will improve their economic status, the latter will enable them to assert their right to secure full benefits of the schemes, prevent leakages, and tailor the schemes to their advantage. The seventh plan approach paper puts the matter correctly when it says, in the ultimate analysis, the objective of removal of poverty can be fulfilled in the measure in which the poor themselves can become conscious, improve their education capacities, and become organized and assert themselves. The next measure is government policy. In the light of the measures suggested above, it would be appropriate that we discuss the government's approach and the measure taken to eliminate poverty. Approach. The government's policy, as reflected in various plans, has all alone been that of the removal of poverty. For this, the problem of poverty has been conceived as one of the low productivity of the poor, which stems from the lack or inadequacy of work or employment, as also from little and poor equipment and almost nil infrastructural facilities such as credit, marketing, etc. To remove these handicap of the poor, as also to integrate them to the growth process, reduction in poverty and associated with it the reduction in unemployment have been treated as the crucial components of the strategy of growth. In concrete terms, three types of measures have been adopted for the removal of poverty. The first is general growth. In that, one concerns molding of the growth strategy in a manner that helps to some extent in improving the conditions of the poor. This involved such a restructuring of the production and the product mix that provided more work or income and more mass goods to the poor. In concrete terms, this is attempted along the following lines: expansion of agricultural and non-farm activities in the rural areas, as also of activities in the unorganized sectors in the urban areas, adoption of labor in the poor. However, it has also been realized that these measures are by themselves not sufficient for the purpose. This awareness became acute in recent years when it was found that the trickle-down effects of the general growth have been of little help. The next is supplementary measures. Second type of measure have been conceived as supplement to the general growth measures. One category of such measures consists of anti-poverty programs like the National Rural Employment Program, NREP, the Integrated Rural Development Program, IRDP, the Rural Landless Employment Guarantee Program, etc. These programs have twofold purpose. In the first place, these provide direct employment on wages paid in cash and in cash and kind, like wheat, etc. Secondly, these help the poor in earning by providing them with assets like land, animals, etc., inputs like raw materials, etc., credit, marketing facilities, training for the skill formation, etc. The government has been expanding these programs by devoting more and more resources and by enlarging its coverage in terms of the number of the poor, the areas and the activities. Another category of measures relate to the provisions of cheap or subsidized food grains to the poor through the public distribution system, PDS. Since the PDS is open to all the poor and non-poor, the system has been so modified as to ensure that the people below the poverty line get specified quantity of food grains at prices lower than those charged for the non-poor. And the third is social uplift. Third type of measure aim at improving the social status of the poor, which also upgrade their productive capabilities. Efforts at raising literacy, widening the access to education and health facilities for the weaker section belonging to the scheduled caste and scheduled tribes and other backward classes enhance the status, the skills and the health of the poor. There are besides special programs for the development of women and the children which empower them in the various ways, including in respect of their legal rights. In addition, several welfare schemes like, for example, change in the occupational status of the scavengers, etc., are meant for the benefit of the poor. The measures listed above, that is, general growth, supplementary measures, and social uplift, together mark the well-conceived strategy. The important thing is to implement them effectively. With this, we complete the chapter 14, Income Distribution and Poverty. Now, moving to the next chapter of Indian Economy, written by A.N. Agarwal. Chapter number 17, Agriculture, Role, Backwardness and Progress. Page number 225 to 240. Agriculture, Role, Progress and Policy. Agriculture is very important sector in Indian economy. It distributes sizably to the domestic product as also to exports. More than two-thirds of the workforce work in agriculture and large many depend upon it being engaged in trade in agricultural products, agro-based industries, etc. We deal with this subject in as many as 12 chapters. In this first chapter, we take up agriculture in general and discuss its role in development, its features and standing in the economy, its backwardness, its progress and government's policy. Coming to the first heading, role in development. Agriculture has an important role to play in the economic development of an agrarian economy like that of India. It has in fact done so, although not satisfactory. The contributions of agriculture may be explained as under. First, supply of food and raw materials. In the development of an economy, agriculture literally feeds the process of development. It meets the needs for food grains on account of raise in incomes as also of increase in population. In addition, it supplies raw materials for many consumer items like edible oils, sugar, cloth, etc. With income elasticity of demand for such items, in particular for food grains, being very high in the underdeveloped countries at around 0.6 as against 0.2 to 0.3 in the developed countries, and the population growth at about 2%, the adequacy of the supplies of such items acquires a key significance. Further, food grains constitute an important wage good in underdeveloped economies. It forms 50-60% of workers' consumption as against 20-30% in developed countries. If the supplies of these goods are not sufficient, the costs or prices go up, jeopardizing the very process of development. Of course, one can argue that in case of shortage, a country can import these goods, but this is neither possible as the foreign exchange is very scarce, nor desirable as the foreign exchange is needed for essential imports for industrial development. Second is supply of labor. Agriculture also contributes to development through the supply of labor. An agricultural country, by definition, provides work to almost the entire labor force of the country. In the less developed countries, quite a significant proportion of the labor force remains in disguised unemployment, as agriculture, being unprogressive and subject to constraints like the given supply of land, is not able to absorb all the increase in the laborers because of rapid population growth productively. As such, agriculture is the major source of labor for the development of non-agricultural sectors like industry and services. No doubt, with the industrial towns or areas coming into existence, the industrial labor in these places itself becomes a source of labor supply through natural increase in population. However, for a long time to come, this is not adequate if the growth of industries and services is to be rapid. Migration from villages thus continues to meet the rising demand for labor in the new areas of development activity. This labor supply is also of help because, being in disguised unemployment, it seeks work at low wages. It permits expansion of industries because with low wages, profit remains high, which in turn can be used for further investment. The noted economist W. A. Lewis has in fact formulated a model of development with such labor treated as unlimited in supplies, being available at low cost, low wages, enabling the capitalist sector to make larger profits and use them for further investment. The next contribution is supply of foreign exchange. Agriculture can contribute a great deal in earning foreign currencies through the export of agricultural products. The requirements for the expansion of exports can be easily met by adding a crop or two within the existing crop pattern, and that too with little incentives and with perhaps no additional capital investments. Further, since such exports have to cater to the existing and familiar international markets, no additional costs are involved to discover or nurse new markets. Again, since exports from any single country constitute a small fraction of the total world supplies, such goods face a fairly elastic demand schedule. India has all such advantages. In recent years, we have made use of these opportunities through the scale of basmati rice, sugar, etc. Further, even expansion of export products as also their sale abroad present no problems. A sound policy to ensure costless incentives like the land reforms to the farmers, a better utilization of existing resources through improved farming practices and effective tapping of foreign markets can expand exports in a short period of time. The result will be an expanded base of supplies and equally expanded outlets for sale outside. The increases in foreign exchange will enable a country to import goods for development.